Conclusions and Those Who Fear Them is the title of today's show and Inside the Black Box, which will be coming up shortly. And really what we're going to do is explore an interesting hypothesis that I, your host, Pete Ledervis, has developed with my colleague, Wendy Neustetter, who is in the Biomedical Engineering, School of Biomedical Engineering, actually, I guess it's Biomedical Engineering Department. It's one of the few things at Georgia Tech that's a department, not a school, because it is a rarity. It is a joint organization with the medical school at Emory, and we had to use department or something like that. But Wendy Neustetter also works with the College of Engineering as sort of an educational person to work with us geeky engineers to try to do things better with engineering education. And literally, I'm going to talk about a RIGI proposal that, provided we fulfill all the paperwork requirements that are now imposed upon us by the sequester. For those of you thinking, well, that's not going to make a difference in my life, we will be investigating conclusion fear, the fact that a lot of students, when they do some really brilliant analysis for us here in science and technology or engineering, in the end are just paralyzed with fear. They don't want to make a conclusion because they're afraid the instructor, who they see as an expert in that domain, is going to slam them with regard to some bizarre point in footnote 3 on page 397 of the textbook, or worse yet, a concept that they wouldn't learn until a graduate class or something like that. So in fact, we'll share with you our strategies, at least at the introductory level, how to get around that, and maybe how to generate some interesting metaphors so that regular people who aren't into science and technology, at least professionally, can help learn these things better and hopefully get students to make conclusions, to trust their judgment, to trust what they believe, and actually go ahead and do that one more, that one additional step. So, an NSF-funded project on conclusions and those who fear them. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Don't adjust your radio, folks. This is Simply Kosher Noise. Oy vey, these promos never get good signal this far from the Holy Land, so tune into Kosher Noise with your host, DJ Meltz. Feel that Hebrew groove all the way from the tips of your payos down to the soles of your tevas. Tune in to Kosher Noise Monday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. with your host, DJ Meltz.
Want to hear the students' point of view on tech athletics? Craving interviews and insight with players and coaches? Looking to put the team on your back, though? Well, turn your radio dials to 91.1 FM or listen in at rec.org to the Ramblin' Rec Report on Wednesdays. That's every Wednesday at 6 p.m. on the home of the true Jacket sports fan, WREK Atlanta.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did. Oh, well. Oh, well.
Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ledervis, and unfortunately I will not be joined by my collaborator on this particular project we'll discuss today, Wendy Neustetter of the Department of Biomedical Engineering and the College of Engineering here at Georgia Tech. We were trying to get Mike Smith, who's with the Scheller College of Business here at Georgia Tech, to come in and talk about IT in the real world. I don't know if that's going to be the title of his show, but he's going to be back in a couple of weeks talking about that very thing. And yes, she is here. And I just sent her an email an hour ago when I was sitting in another thing across campus. So while Wendy's getting situated, our crack engineer, Austin Red, is going to get her in front of a microphone. Actually, a big shout out to Austin Red. We finally found the disclaimer the theme music and the Science in the News liner as well. Trent, if you've already moved to D.C., we found it and we're moving on. But like I said, before we get to Science in the News, the title of today's program is Conclusions and Those Who Fear Them. All right, and I'm Wendy, you want to move that seat behind me? All right, we're going to do a little logistics here. So, Austin, is Mike 2 still not good? Should we put Mike 2 out of commission? So we're going to put our guests on Mike 3 and 4. And I recognize the strange person that Wendy has brought with us, but I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name because I know I'm going to butcher it. Wendy's having difficulty with the chair. It's one of those ergonomic chairs. Not sure what that means. You have to ask an English major.
Ergo.
Is that really, it refers to ergo? Okay, so we're going to try to get you guys about 2 inches from the microphone, so you can grab these. I will try to get you some headphones as well. This is live college radio, ladies and gentlemen, with an all-volunteer staff. It doesn't get any more real than
only
that.
Only the finest.
All right, we're working with plugs and all sorts of things like that. And you guys, you can adjust. Actually, you don't want to pass that one down. He's got one down there as well. All right, so you can adjust this here if you need to. Oh, you got the... Okay, so we're all good. All right, so let me allow my distinguished guests to introduce themselves, because I just assumed Wendy's like, what? 2 hours? What are you thinking? I can't make that. So go ahead, guys.
I'm Wendy Neustetter, and I am the Director of Educational Research and Innovation in the Dean's Office in the College of Engineering.
Okay, so I butchered your intro before you came on. And...
Oh, I'm Dave Majerik. I'm a research scientist. I work in the Center for 21st Century Universities, and I like educational research, so that's why I'm here to talk.
So, Dave, it's nice to meet you finally. And you have no phone number listed here.
I do not.
Is that on purpose? Is that a clever ploy that you did so people can't bother you at home?
I do enjoy liking to be hidden. But okay. I do have a phone number. Okay. It's just not made public.
Okay. Will I ever get that phone
yes,
number?
Yes, you will.
Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, you're experiencing something very interesting here. The first live meeting of the collaborators on this particular project. We need to put together a, what do we call it, an assessment vehicle? Is that the technical term for it?
Strategy.
And a strategy even before the assessment vehicle.
What are we assessing?
We're assessing whether or not this goofy hypothesis we came up with actually works. So we'll just.
Did you share this with us, your goofy hypothesis?
Yeah. Well, I shared it with you. You're on the proposal. You do realize that.
I know, but you're the comedian.
Okay. All right. So let's do this before we jump. So, to our listeners, you're going to experience something new that you've never heard before. Live science strategy stuff. Do you guys have a better piece of jargon for that one?
No, I think stuff is pretty scientific.
Stuff is really good. And before we do that, all right, now Wendy's tossed my
science. I hope NSF isn't listening.
No, I'm sure that NSF knows that this sort of organic evolution of the assessment is possibly the best way to do this, right?
Yeah. In fact, on the fly.
Don't we call this action research and education?
Oh, where you could be.
Sort
could
of try
be.
Something. And actually, we're trying to do something that's not... action research. Okay, so now I'm looking all through my notes here, and I'm looking at notes from two weeks
ago. Let's go back to
ago.
The start of this, Pete. Where did this idea come from that you needed to be more humorous in a chemical engineering class?
Well, to be honest, we have two hypotheses in this particular one. One is that humor can better engage students. The other is that by using sort of examples that are outside the domain expertise of the instructor, that we can get students who do perfectly good analysis and mathematical calculations to take that additional step of making a conclusion about what that means. And I was going to take the latter one because, and we can get into the former one if we want, because I figure that will probably fill an hour anyway. And where it started from was, and feel free to chime in and let me know if you observed the same thing, that... we give the students an assignment. And the assignment, you know, sometimes we do the worst thing ever. We give them contrived data, which we should never do, right? I mean, they should actually get the data themselves. That experience is a very useful one. But we give them contrived data. And the contrived data is in the domain of the particular class. And granted, by the time you're a senior, you better be analyzing, you know, domain-specific data. And by domain-specific data, I mean data in that subject, right? I was just sitting through several hours of training this morning for the GT1000 class. Why doesn't biomedical engineering teach a GT1000 section?
We have our own.
You have your own Biomed 1000.
BME 1000.
Yeah, which is great. Problem-based learning. Nobody can get into it, though, can they?
Not unless you're a BME.
Well, if you're BME, but you guys have so many students now, it's just that popular. To what do you attribute this runaway popularity of biomedical engineering? Wasn't that from a bad movie somewhere?
I have a couple hypotheses about that.
What are your hypotheses? I'm just kind of curious.
I think it's the best way to think about biomedical engineering is as the liberal arts of science and technology.
Ah, okay.
Now, if you think about that, it means that you aren't forced to commit to a particular strand of engineering. You actually get to experience in 4 years a great deal of chemistry, biosciences, different kinds of engineering. Mm-hmm. And I think with millennials, I think they have a hard time committing because they have too much information out there.
That could be true.
And I think another reason is right now all of the cool stuff in science is going on the frontiers of the biosciences and engineering. So neuroprosthetics, you know, biomaterials, tissue engineering, all of these things that seem to capture the imagination of a lot of young people are happening not in one discipline like chemi, which I think students think that's all about chemical plants. So I think that's another reason as well.
So, and I think you get two responses to that from the engineers. You get one, the grumpy old guys who go, well, that's not real engineering. In fact, that was actually told to me when my daughter, who is majoring in biomedical engineering, but she wants to be a vet. So I actually thought biomedical engineering would be better than straight biology for what she wants to do. And she may very well, if she doesn't get into vet school or go to vet school, and I know she's going to curse me for saying that because what? Why wouldn't I get into vet school? I think my daughter's brilliant. I really do. I think she's absolutely fabulous. And she has great study habits. But vet school's tough. She may change her mind at that point.
Tougher than med school.
Yeah, it's certainly tougher to get in than med school. So she may get a PhD in neurology or something like that. So I think it's a good stepping stone for that. But then there are other slightly less grumpy, but they're just as grumpy. I'm thinking of Jonathan Colton from mechanical engineering.
I know Jonathan well. He's grumpy.
Yeah, but he's not grumpy in the sense that, you know, he thinks...
He's dogmatic.
Is he really?
He can be dogmatic.
Well, but he is someone who believes in, and let's get it right, you called it the liberal arts. What was it again? The
liberal arts of science and technology.
Okay. So he came up with a topic called, was it liberal engineering or engineering arts? You got to combine the two in two ways. There's a guy up in Canada who calls it one, and Jonathan calls it the other.
Nice.
And I forget the jargon. But it is that, you know, we need people that are scientifically trained, but also work on the interface with what I like to call on this show, normal people. I'm not sure I would put Jonathan in that camp. And that's a compliment to Jonathan. He's the ultimate geek. I'm not normal either. I'm definitely a geek. So there it is.
It's
at the interface. Mm-hmm. All right. So I think, can we go to our segment that we often start the show with?
Science in the news.
Okay, and today's Science in the News is biological in origin, so feel free to comment on this one. And it has to do with a new study that actually came out of Tel Aviv University's Sackler Faculty of Medicine, it's ear, nose, and throat in Latin. Okay, I'm not even going to try that one. And it was a study head by Dr. Yaniv Hamzani, where they actually were looking at the saliva in humans. And they looked at heavy cell phone users, and they looked at non-cell phone users. And I know what you're thinking, what's a non-cell phone user? Do you know what he did? And I thought this was very brilliant. And this is a good example.
Husband.
He used deaf people as his control. And if you think about it, if you can hear And you don't, you are either using a cell phone or you're probably just really strange. You don't talk to other people. I don't know. But that's an example of just being using a clever piece of common sense to find a control. And I think a lot of our students wouldn't think, oh, my common sense isn't worth it.
Every time I call you, you don't return my call.
Do I not return? Are you calling my cell phone or my...
Your cell phone. Are you in that second category?
No, I. My wife would say I'm deaf. I call it selective hearing. But in any case, what is it? I'm having transition problems, right? I now have two phone numbers and a cell phone number, and I don't even know both your numbers, right? Because you left them on my cell phone, and I accidentally erased the thing. So you have two numbers. So let's get off the high horse and realize we should consolidate for one number. That's what we should do. But in any case, it's a real example of the fact that cancer is tricky. That's it. I'm gonna stick with that sort of thing. And I'm a chemical engineer, so trust me, I give a lot of lectures on the scale for the International, the International Agency of Research on Cancer. They have four categories, and because it's so tricky, they split category two into two pieces a little while ago. So category one is carcinogenic to humans, right? And that's things like tobacco, asbestos, vinyl chloride. It's usually when we had millions of people exposed to it, and we have a clear illustration. There's no laboratory rats involved in group number one. And then group number two, they split into 2A and 2B, probably carcinogenic, and possibly carcinogenic, which I really love. The probably carcinogenic is usually associated with some kind of animal studies, right? So when we first did, some of these sweeteners.
Aspartame.
Is aspartame there? That's a relatively new one. I'm thinking back of the old ones, cyclamates and saccharin.
Saccharin, right.
Yeah, so saccharin was definitely in 2A because it caused cancer in laboratory rats, but then they kept exposing Europeans to it for 30 years and turned out, well, unless you eat 90 pounds, didn't have a problem. And I do believe, and what's interesting about this paper that recently came out in Antioxidants and Redox Signaling, so that's reduction in oxidation, right?
Within the cell.
Right, exactly. So it's a signaling thing. And it is, I actually looked it up. Isn't it nice to have this ability to look this up in the library? And what they did is, one would say, and the reason cancer is so tough is cancer takes a long time to develop, and cancer becomes cancer long before we usually detect it. This vinyl chloride, rare liver cancer that's caused by vinyl chloride, it takes 10 to 20 years to develop. So it's really hard to say, oh, you did this, and 3 weeks later you have symptoms. So that's why cancer is very, very difficult. So these guys are doing a good example of sort of a proxy test. They're not looking at cancer. They're looking at oxidative stress in your saliva. So the result of oxidation, which is sometimes due to lots of free radicals forming that might be due to the radiation that is in proximity of very important glands near there. Those radicals, this is why I told people take vitamin C and antioxidants, have been linked to cancer. Mm-hmm. So there is no clear link there, but they're publishing this study, and they're reminding us that the World Health Organization, that controls this International Agency for Research on Cancer, recently put this in Category 2B. So I wish I had a better answer for you, like, yes, it caused cancer. No, it doesn't cause cancer. But the data indicate that we should be watching this thing, that there's no clear link yet, so don't go crazy and bury yourself in a bunker in Nevada somewhere. But keep watching the studies. And I wish sometimes science would give us a better answer than that, but it doesn't. So deal with it. That's what I'm saying. Okay, enough about cancer. That's depressing. All right, let's move on to jokes in the classroom. Should we have called the proposal that?
As I recall, your chair wouldn't have let it go through.
Okay. No, that's okay. He did give me a smirk. There was a little snicker when I had him sign the thing. But I will say this. So the title of the proposal is Intervention to Improve Engagement and Mediate Conclusion Fear in Engineering Education. And the conclusion fear was your doing. So I'm going to blame this one on you. And you said to me, I think that, actually, what you said to me is something that Nobel laureate Harry Croteau once said. He said, it has to have a cool name. And do we get picked on this? The educational people get picked on for the jargon sometime. I mean, how do you guys
feel? Yeah, we have a lot of
that?
Jargon.
So you have a lot of jargon. Now, there's the good side,
that's
the bad side.
That's because we're smarter than engineers.
Okay. Now, the engineers, we'll get calls after the break on that one. I mean, so there's a good reason for jargon. Jargon is a compact way to discuss things among domain experts, right? And you're not the worst, by the way. So the engineers, I work with folks that do photoresists and make CPUs in the microelectronics industry. They use the abbreviation CD for critical dimension. I'm like, really? You can't say critical dimension? So we're all guilty of it, right? So it's not just educational people.
It goes to the book Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow.
What exactly does that mean?
It means that the human brain is always trying to find ways to mitigate cognitive load.
Okay.
And the way it does
mitigate
that...
Mitigate cognitive load. You're doing it again.
Yep. Mitigate cognitive load. What do you think that means?
To find a way to alleviate this tremendous learning load on the brain.
Yeah. Or just maintaining load. If you're trying to do several things at once... your working memory is limited.
Right. Mine certainly is.
Yes. And yours particularly is limited. But anyway, so in order to deal with the limitations of working memory, the brain is always looking for ways to bundle things up.
Right.
And bring them down to a procedural level so that they're automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always going to do that because then it... diminishes the load on the cognition.
Right. Okay.
And so I think the move towards, you know, acronyms, things like that, is part of that.
Right. And it's done by everyone, right? So in effect, is your background in linguistics?
Yeah.
So, I mean, linguists will talk about, you know, these minimal sets of phonemes and things like that to organize language. The computer guys do it the same as well. So any RISC computer, a reduced instruction set, tries to combine the right things. But then when you combine them, we get into trouble because it's very useful to talk among experts. But when you talk to non-experts, and let me use an example that I got today. So I was in several hours of training for the freshman seminar GT1000 class. Okay, I saw the gesture that you're making there. and in fact, my office, the Center for Academic Enrichment, is now in charge of said class. And what were we getting? We were getting a riveting lecture by Beth Spencer from the Center of Academic Success. And it was on, what was it on? It was on self-regulated learning. And here's the thing. You say self-regulated learning to a bunch of physicists and engineers in this thing, and they're just like self-regulated learning. But the truth is, once you get beyond the jargon, right? So you're right. The cognitive load thing makes perfect sense. Help me with my memory. Self-regulated learning sounds complicated, and don't ever look it up on Wikipedia. So I Wikipedia'd it while she was looking at it, and it said, learning governed by metacognition. But in defense of those that use jargon, you, me, everyone else, it's really... thinking about the way you learn and applying that as you learn. So even though people like to make fun of our acronyms and things like that, for you to say, look, for me, I'm a visual learner, right? So in fact, I'm working on a NIST proposal where the first thing I'm coming up with is a diagram of all the different parts of the center work together. In fact, you suggested get me a good diagram for how this hypothesis is going to work. So that works for me. It's useful to, what is it, to...
But I don't think it's you as a visual learner. Uh-huh. You are part of a community of practice.
Okay.
Your community of practice is engineers.
They like diagrams.
And engineers, they don't just like them. Their whole knowledge-making practices, their epistemology.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Big word.
You'll have to define epistemology.
Epistemology is knowledge-making practices, what you value in terms of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
How you undertake the acquisition of knowledge. So the knowledge-making, the epistemological practices of engineers are what we call model-based reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
So the model, the visual conceptual model, is the anchor that drives knowledge creation for engineers.
Yeah, so you're right. I often explain to my freshman engineers that they ask me, what do chemical engineers do? And I say, they draw boxes. And the boxes are... boxes with arrows connected, so we describe it as a process, as a model, right? Mm-hmm. This goes to that. So, for example, the best description of this type of learning we were talking about actually came from Ed Greco in physics.
Mm-hmm.
He said you sort of try a way of learning, and then you evaluate that, and then you go back, and then you modify that. He described it as a model, a feedback control loop. And that works for him. He's a physicist. That works for me. I'm an engineer. We like that sort of stuff. So the point is... even though people make fun of, you know, the jargon like that, the idea of continuously evaluating this, what was it again, epistemology?
Epistemology.
The way you do this is extremely valuable.
Or knowing how you do it.
Yes, exactly. And I don't think you do. I don't think freshmen know how they do it. So that's why Ed suggests it's kind of a feedback control loop where you go round and round.
Right.
And I'm still trying to figure out how I learn things. I have a better idea than when I was an undergraduate and mm-hmm. things like that. Okay, so let's get to that diagram and this crazy hypothesis. And in fact, let's do this. Let's take a break. Have you got some stuff loaded up there? And then when we come back, we'll talk about the hypothesis. What do we call it? Crazy hypothesis? Silly hypothesis? Funny hypothesis? And get into the nitty-gritty.
Outrageous.
Of outrageous. The National Science Foundation didn't think so. So it must be good. Mediating conclusion fear in engineering education. And we'll be right back with that topic here on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
Then the war did soon engage, woman to woman and man to man. Shillelagh law was all the rage, and our own eruption soon began.
And shillelagh law still is all the rage. Every Monday night from 8 to 9 p.m., your host, J.J. O'Brien, brings you Irish, Scottish, and other forms of Celtic music. That's Shillelagh Law, every Monday night from 8 to 9 p.m., right here on WREK Atlanta.
The liquor scattered over Tim. You got hero
vibes? Break!
Do you love hip-hop but hate what you hear on the radio? Then you might want to tune in to the Rec Room Renaissance, Atlanta's hottest hip-hop show every Thursday night from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. to hear the best in new music from established local and international artists. That's the Rec Room Renaissance every Thursday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta.
You like that? If you want to listen to more smooth African tunes like this one, tune in to Sub-Saharan Vibes from 9 to 10 p.m. every Monday on WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
For over 35 years, the Stonehenge Show on WREK 91.1 FM has brought the very finest underground classic rock to lovers of the music you never hear on commercial radio. Stonehenge begins at 8 p.m. every Friday night with the classic rock album of the week. Then we kick off the weekend in fine style with more than 3 hours of the finest rock music in the cosmos. Stonehenge, putting the class back into classic rock.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Wendy Neustetter and David Majerik, did I get that right, about educational engineering stuff, and hopefully in a few minutes more specifically, a title that Wendy is not happy about on the NSF proposal. So,
no, I'm quite happy with it. I had forgotten we came up with that.
Okay. Oh, okay, but okay. So you're denying making cracks about the title? You know, so the motto is science only funnier. We can be honest, right?
Yes.
And we do. So we were poking fun at jargon before, but despite the jargon, scientific principles with jargon can be very important, whether it's in education. We reviewed a paper on the humor of Eddie Izzard with a very bright anthropologist from a college in New York. And he explained, you know, how Eddie Izzard's humor works, that he takes things out of context and time.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly he's a modern man as an imperialist Brit who's taking over India and all these things. And he just plops a flag down. It's a very, very funny bit. You can watch it on YouTube if you haven't seen it. And then he does the same thing with the colonies and Native Americans. And of course, he does that one second, because he gets you to understand the concept, then he picks on you, right? I made jokes about British food in London once. Huge mistake. changed, made fun of haggis first. If you pick on Scotland or Ireland first, then you can make any joke you want about the Brits. So very useful things. And by coming out of time, and changing the time, he used the phrase chronotope and designed that. So there's the jargon. And you see why he calls it chronotope, right? Mm-hmm. It's this time shift to change the cognitive, you know, perspective and things like that. But it's really just, you know, he's a modern guy in old times, and it makes it funny. So
anachronisms.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
It's anachronisms.
He is based on his humor is based on anachronisms. So, all right. So let's get back to your original question. When you just came barged in here, I thought you weren't going to make it and threw me off my game. Right? I'm normally much more.
If you had read your email, you would know I was going.
Yeah, but
to come.
I was in a thing, so I was walking over here. I couldn't read email. Okay. No, but we're glad you're here. Absolutely. Even though I'm thrown off my game.
We could leave.
No, don't leave. Don't leave me here alone. So conclusion fear. So this started with me teaching various classes in chemical and biomolecular engineering, specifically the unit operations lab. And when we do unit operations lab, they take their own data. But for the first couple weeks, they're getting some lectures on statistical calculations and safety in the lab. So they're not in the lab at first. So I this is not my idea. One of my colleagues during that time period would give them a virtual lab. And the virtual lab was designed to check, do they knew how to do calculations and things like that, and do linear regression and nonlinear regression and all these sorts of things. And it was a great idea, but he gave them, you know, really boring paper mill data from something about the amount of starch or something in some effluent stream. And it's very relevant data, but I observed that when I gave those kinds of data, I could get people to the end, they do the data, and then where I was expecting this nice, rich, full half-page paragraph or two of what this means is that, and I didn't even care if I agreed with what it meant. I just wanted to see. No, and it could be completely wrong. Maybe they had a mistake in their data analysis. I want them to make a conclusion, and they didn't. It was just this withered little, oh, this means, and I just was very dissatisfying. And then I started doing weird stuff. So I gave them data that, and by the way, I wish I could say that it occurred to me, this hypothesis, if I gave them data outside the expertise of chemical engineering, perhaps they won't feel as constrained in making a conclusion. I wish I could say that. And by the way, when we write the paper after this, that's how we write the paper. Well, we speculated. It's a lie. I did it purely by accident because I was bored. So I gave them weird stuff. And the weird stuff I gave them was, and one of my colleagues in math actually said, go to the internet and find data. There's all sorts of data out there. So I found data on movie box office receipts. And you have to like pay $35 to get the full data. But if you're willing to take only the weekend receipts, you can get it for free. And then we did some experiments with swelling gummy bears, because that's what they do in elementary school classrooms. They swell gummy bears. And they're like, oh, look, the water goes in. But I can make them do a differential equation model of the gummy bears and then fit it with nonlinear regression and all sorts of stuff. We had them do, in another class, differential equations, you know, set up these big differential equations. And if I did it in, you know, heat transfer, what I found is I got better conclusions out of that, purely because I did funny stuff, because I have a twisted sense of humor, and I thought that would be cool. And I just got better conclusions. And the one of the better
examples... Wait. Okay, slow down. You got the better conclusions with the gummy bear stuff?
I got the better conclusions with the funny stuff. The gummy bears, the movie box office receipts.
Didn't you do something with chick flicks and...
Yes. Okay. So
tell us about that, because that was cool.
And that was okay. Hopefully, we won't get some harassment suit filed against these. Is that what you're hoping for? You're hanging me out there. I'm twisting in the wind. But it was.
What was the data?
So the data was.
What was the question they were asking in the study?
Well, I gave them data on four different types of films.
Uh-huh.
And I gave it to them for two different seasons, sort of the December holiday season, where a lot of people go to movies, and the summer season, where a lot of people go to movies. And I wanted to literally just do a simple ANOVA test, so an analysis of variance, to see if they were statistically different. And just see, you know, did it make a difference? Do people like to see, so I think it was action films, family movies, romantic comedies, and something else. I don't
Thrillers.
Remember what it was. Maybe it was. I mean, there was an action movie in there. Mm. And I don't remember exactly what it was. We sometimes use different data. We've done this a couple different times. And one of the groups found that there was a statistically significant difference for 3 out of 4 between the summer and the holiday season, but not for romantic comedies. So, and that was their conclusion, that it appears that, and your conclusion should be that at least between these two seasons, there is no statistical difference. Perhaps this is due to the fact that demand for these movies is relatively constant compared to the other ones. And they said one possible reason for this is women tend to like these kinds of movies. And as a disclaimer, I will say I'm a big fan of romantic comedies. My wife, I hope she considers herself very lucky for that reason. I took my daughter to see The Prince and Me. Have you seen that film? Mm-hmm. It was about this college girl who meets the Prince of Denmark at University of Wisconsin. Austin, have you seen it? Even if you did, you wouldn't admit it. I like it. You know, it's a bad rendition of Cinderella, but I'm in the movie theater with my daughter, and it's me, my daughter, 47, you know, middle school girls and their mothers. But what these guys concluded is they said, if your wife or girlfriend is going to drag you to this film, she's going to do it regardless of the time of year. And they labeled it the chick flick effect. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, two of the three members of that group were women. So this wasn't three guys imposing a very serious sexist stereotype.
This was based on experience.
I think it was. So the point is, they trusted their experience.
Yeah.
And the guy who was in their group actually is now doing a NIH MD PhD fellowship. He's absolutely brilliant. But he was pushed around by the two women there. I'm good friends with him and them, so I can say that it was kind of like, okay, whatever. But he's a really bright guy. This guy scored higher on the MCATs than any student I've ever seen in recent memory. And I don't think he would have let them put it down unless he agreed with it. So he's going to be an MD PhD. So there it is. So that's just an example of them trusting their, just, the point is, if you have nothing out there, if it's research, you have to sort of trust your experience.
But what experience do these students have in paper mills that they would be able to trust anything?
Well, they have none.
Yeah. So, of course, they're going to be fearful or even reluctant or resistant, actually, to drawing conclusions about a paper mill that they've never been in and they barely even understand the process.
Right.
So it's actually no wonder that they're unwilling to do it, because in a way they'd be kind of idiots to do it because they don't have that personal experience.
Yeah, I think they see it as a trap. And this is something that our pretest assessment vehicle needs to sort of test. And actually, my colleague, Cliff Henderson, actually suggested us looking at the perception of, on the topic, do they consider themselves an expert on it, and does the instructor, and that 2x2 square of that sort of thing, what it might actually make a difference. So yeah, I think it's a simple concept. And by the time they're seniors, well, we can't give them gummy bear things through the whole 4 years. They have to design a chemical plant at some point. But by the time they're seniors, they have more experience at that. This is a sophomore level class. It's the second class they've taken. They don't have a lot of experience. And then I think if they suddenly realize that, well, okay, well, my experience and my logic is useful, then later when it's a technical problem, they can hopefully extrapolate and do that. Because let's face it, don't we do that as well?
I was thinking about that. You know, we in biomedical engineering, we have this problem-based learning, and the students in one of the problems have to conduct an original experiment around some kind of biomedical device. It could be a blood pressure cuff or something. And what's really interesting is they have to write up the report as an experimental report, something that would look like something that would go into a journal. So introduction, you know, background literature, method, results, and then discussion. Okay. And when as I'm hearing you talk, I'm reminded that, first of all, when they start to this problem, they have no idea what a discussion section is.
Okay.
First of all, they don't understand the function of a discussion section. You know,
yet they still write a discussion section, and you get all sorts of stuff.
Well, they need help with that, because and the other thing they don't understand is if they're unable to disprove the null hypothesis, they think they've done a bad job.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yes.
That's
okay.
Interesting.
And they get really upset if they can't do that.
Right.
And we have to help them understand that, you know, often in science, that's the best thing that could happen because mm-hmm. it's an opportunity to open up ways of thinking, new pathways that right. hadn't been there. And that what the discussion section is an opportunity to step back from the data, mm-hmm. look at the data, say, what does this mean? And they really, until they're introduced to the function of the discussion section, mm-hmm. they just don't get it. They think it's a conclusion, which is just to reiterate what they've done.
Oh, okay. So they just reiterate the numbers that came out of their...
Right. Yeah. So now I'm beginning to think that some of this resistance, reluctance, whatever you're seeing, maybe mm-hmm. they don't understand the function of the conclusion section.
Right.
That it's an opportunity to step back from... to look at your data from a different perspective, right. say, what does this mean? And it's often it's speculation,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, and if you have no idea why the experiment, you know, spun off the turntable,
right.
you're
right.
actually out there trying to figure out, could it be this, could it be this, could it be this?
Right.
But that sets up your next line of inquiry.
And sometimes the experiment is not a good experiment either. I mean, so I've got a student doing research for me now, a very bright student who is a biomedical engineer, by the way, by the name of Drew, who we had a hard time getting our simulations working. We had a license server failure, and we literally spent 3 weeks just trying to get OIT to help us get this thing to work. He finally got some good data, but the semester's over, right? So he's like, well, what should I calculate? I said, well, he's got a Pura grant. He's going to be back here in the fall. I said, the first thing you need to do is literally take that data, animate the molecules, and just see what they do. Mm-hmm. I said, so before you give me these distributions of angles, which I also asked for, look and see if we put this in this all elongated state and we want it to curl up in a beta turn, does it do anything? That looks like a beta turn. Then let's do the numbers. Maybe they're just all garbage. Maybe they don't do anything. Actually, I don't think they are. I think we're getting some good results. But just this sort of, I'm going to look at it and experience it, and my judgment, you know, even qualitatively at the beginning is okay. Mm. They're just like, I need some numbers. I got to put some numbers on the table. When I talk to high school students, they have their calculator glued to their hand. So the idea of discussing, interpreting, and concluding about data, I think, is really important. And in fact, so you mentioned about disproving the null hypothesis, mm-hmm. right? So immediately you're turning people off. As we speak, people are tuning out of the video program now. You know, you have a hypothesis. So let me take an example that I used to illustrate this. And I can't use the data anymore because I've used the example so many times. And it has to do with my daughter Miranda's fourth grade science project. She hates when I mention this. I do this in front of my class, and she came here for one of these summer things, not a facet one, but a different one, some connect with tech thing. And she met one of my students who was one of the volunteers. And she goes, oh, you're the Oreo cookie girl. And she's like, oh, I can't believe you talk about that in class. So for her fourth grade science project, she tried to analyze a hypothesis that I had. And my hypothesis was that the Oreo cookies in the vending machine have less cream filling than the Oreo cookies in the store. Because to me, they always tasted drier. And at this point, it requires me to admit that I'm a type A loser who often eats his lunch and dinner out of the vending machine. So that was my hypothesis. So I had her test it. And the nice thing is, years ago, you couldn't test this. Now you can go to Sam's Club and get a whole bunch of the vending packs mm-hmm. and do, you know, 50 cookies like that without having to pay, what is it, like $1.15
sure.
for Oreo cookies out of the vending machine? So she weighed the cookies, and then we scraped the cream filling off, and then we weighed the cookie wafers. So you have an inherent error. There's a little bit in the nooks and crannies of there, but you can quantify basically what that is. And so our hypothesis is that they're different. So our null hypothesis is that they're the same statistically, and to disprove that with an analysis of variance is how you do it. And we don't do this to torment people. It's just the way statistics work. You can prove if things are different. You can't prove if things are the same. It's just the way statistics work. So you look at the two bars in the bar graph for the store-bought and the other one of the cream filling. Spot on. We graphed it with the 99% confidence intervals, and they are tiny. So these things were statistically different to a confidence level of like 99.999%, or for the bio people, a significance level of less than like 0.0001. So there's no way these things are different. But what's interesting is, and this is the interesting thing about science, is There's a great, great quote by Isaac Asimov that a good friend of mine first introduced me to, who's a comedian who also writes about science. And that is that eureka is not the thing you hear when people discover stuff. It's, that's funny. It's always the weird stuff. It's sometimes the failure of the experiment.
That's weird.
Or disproving the null hypothesis and, failure to, wait, now you got me confused. But the point is, it's you didn't prove the hypothesis you set out to do. So we didn't do that, but then we found that the cookies in the store-bought ones were almost 15% higher, and that was extremely statistically significant. And then you wonder why. So that's the interesting part. And I wish I could go back and sort of do this experiment, but I'm going to look for some like this. And it turns out that I can get a lot of mileage out of these jokes. I wrote RJR Nabisco, and then they wrote me back saying there's no difference between the way they manufacture it. And then I made up some additional letters to RJR Nabisco that are rather funny. I think what it really means, and the only conclusion, if you know anything about the permeability of water to aluminum foil versus cellophane, is the cookies in the store get a little bit of humidity, and they get a little...
puffed up.
Yeah, they're not as dry. Mm. So they taste better. And then anyone can take the asymptotic limit of that. You think about a cookie, it tastes better with a little bit of humidity. If I dunk it in milk, it's the ultimate eating experience. That's the limit of the asymptote. This must be true. Now, we haven't tested it. The joke I say is I try to get some colleagues at Arizona State to test it, and they have not returned my phone calls, which is true. But so there it is. That's a personal experience. And when it's research, and as I said to my students, if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be research. At that point, you have to look at it and say, what could it be? It might be this, it might be that. It's okay to say, look, this is speculation, however, and put it down there. And like I said, I don't care if it's wrong. I told them, I said, if you make a wrong conclusion and it's wrong because of something you will learn in a PhD level class that you don't know, but your data support it, that will get a better grade than you doing nothing at all. Yet they still remain afraid. So, I don't know. It's utterly crazy. You told me in your problem-based learning class that you had similar sorts of experiences, the ones that you were talking about before.
As I said, I think once they understood the function of the discussion section, which was not conclusion, and that might be another problem, because in the vernacular, they equate conclusion with a lot of high school writing they've done, where you just sum up what you've done.
Ah, okay. As opposed to draw something
new. Because think about it, in a scientific article, you have a discussion section and then you may have a conclusion.
Right.
And they're separate. They serve different functions.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if by your asking them to write the conclusion, they're doing what they would do in a composition class.
And is that basically just a summary?
It's a summary.
Right, which in fact should go at the beginning and include the conclusion.
But it's not a discussion section.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think we have a lot to actually explore here.
Right. Yeah. Right, and in fact...
So David, what's interesting to you about this study?
Yeah, and are we completely full of crap? Because we have not heard from you on this yet.
No, I'm interested in this. I'm interested to see how far above the data the conclusions are written. Mm-hmm. Because more than likely... they're just reporting the type of the types of data that they have, and the inferences are too connected to the data. Still, they don't know how to back off.
Okay. And so, what do you mean by how far above the data?
Well, if I have, let's say, I'm analyzing five apples for some particular phenomenon, in the conclusion, I typically see a description of the five apples again without. A higher level analysis of what occurred.
Right.
So the supposition is missing.
Okay. So the point is you can use terms like supposition, right? That. So what you're saying is the conclusion should go beyond a simple regurgitation of the data and the results from that.
Absolutely.
Okay. But the question is, how far can you go? Some scientists go very far. I mean, there is a decent balance. And to be honest, I think it's perfectly fine as long as you agree that, you know, this is one possible cause of this. And by the way, outline the next set of experiments to test that.
Right.
That's exactly what future work in a PhD thesis should be.
Right.
That conclusion is actually a point of departure for future research.
Yes.
So that will guide where you go next.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so that actually suggests something we hadn't even talked about, that maybe one of the interventions that we actually try in the class is we say that in this conclusion section, discussion section, reflect on the data, reflect back on the data, try to figure out what it means, and also try to figure out what would future, you know, data collection strategies be that would spin out of what you found. And see, then they understand that the function of that is, it's actually a pivot, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. It's a pivot from the data that they've collected and into what data they might collect next.
Right. Right.
And I suspect that they're not understanding it as that serving that function. Right.
I'd like to add to that as well. In my experience teaching chemistry and physics, I've noticed that the stronger conclusions always come from those students who can describe what they did in the experiment. They understand the experiment and the nature of it. Those that are a little unsure about what they just did, for instance, if it's just a cookbook procedure and they're following the steps of a cookbook procedure, the conclusions are not as strong. But those that can articulate in their own words what just occurred or what they could possibly be looking for, with a little bit of reference to theory and content, that would help.
So to that end, does that mean that the experiments that we do for students, right? I mean, obviously, if you're a graduate student, you have a relatively open-ended thing. You better understand it or you're not going to cut it in graduate school. Need to be the more open-ended type. And we tend to give them these procedures and they just follow them. And then you say, what does it mean? They have no idea.
There's a difference between an activity and an experiment. And most of what occurs at the undergraduate level would be activities.
Okay.
And that is a known outcome.
So how do we get away from that? And let me tell you why instructors are afraid of giving you a real experiment. We're afraid because, you know, it's big, expensive equipment. We don't want you to mess it up. We're lazy. We don't want to grade this open-ended thing where the data is sometimes really strange or weird. I mean, to be honest, I have colleagues in chemical engineering who just go, here's the thing, characterize this, boom. Your procedure. Now, they can give you some the shutdown and startup procedure. Don't turn on the gas and water line into the fluidized bed or it will explode. That sort of stuff, all the safety stuff. So I'm working on a lab now, and I'm going to execute a radical departure from the way we do our unit operations lab, and it's on two-phase flow.
This is an educational lab?
Yeah, this is an educational lab. Okay. And I'm simply going to say, here's some background stuff, which they can read. And if they realize this, you can describe the phase of the flow. Does the air or the gas form a big slug? Does it form little bubbles, small bubbles? Does it form a channel, like an annulus through this sort of thing? And I'm simply going to say, characterize the conditions under which you form this, this, and this. And they have a phase diagram with very complicated non-dimensional coordinates and things, but I'm just going to say do it.
So how does that help them in a real, when they get out of here in a real live lab setting?
Ooh, so actually this, and maybe this is a good thing, this was suggested by Chevron. So Chevron said, look, you're not teaching them about multi-phase flow. Both our chemical engineers and people in general think, you know, you drill an oil well and a gusher of liquid black oil comes up. Hardly ever happens that way. Certainly no more. Usually what happens is you have to go pump in all sorts of either hydraulic fracturing fluids, which is very big in the media right now, or other things that will get things out of the fissures of these rocks. And when it comes up, it's either mixed with gas pockets and oil or there's other things. So you very often have both gas and liquid. You have water, oil, other stuff, sand, gravel, and gas. And they were complaining they didn't understand this two-phase flow between gases and liquids. So we're using water and air, much safer than oil and methane. But the principles are the same. And so because they don't understand that if they make a certain shift in pressure or temperature or things like that, they can suddenly shift it to having the gas dissolved in the water versus not dissolved in the water. And that change can blow apart pumps. So it's very, very relevant. And of course, you know.
But is it relevant to the students? Do they have this backstory you just told?
So this is what I would put in the introduction. And explain why. And actually, the text that we're using to sort of teach this does a very good job at that sort of thing. But then don't give them tested at these pressures and these temperatures. Just simply say, characterize it. And then, comment on any deviation between the theoretical phase diagram and things like that. Try to lead them so that they look at, oh, in the middle of the phases, it's always very good. But at the interface, there's a lot of error. There's some sensitivity issues depending on whether if you change the flow of the gas, very sensitive. If you change the flow of the liquid, not so sensitive. Those are the kinds of things. And that's just three or four questions that are open-ended.
So because I come from the school of problem-based learning,
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you could turn that into a problem to be solved.
Okay.
So they're actually doing the characterization
right.
for a reason, because they're trying to figure something out.
Okay.
Maybe it's a design question.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's even better because,
right.
how do you frame the function and the need for characterization in the context of good mm-hmm. design?
Right. Right.
So, I mean, then they have a motivation to characterize because it's going to allow them to solve a problem.
So what you're saying is pick a real example and
yes.
say transition from bubble to slug flow is very important for this application because of this.
Yes.
And basically have them write a report on how to accomplish that or avoid it or things like that.
Yes. See, that's very,
very
real world okay. then because it's
yeah.
I mean, they have to come up with a product, but it's open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
And, you could either drop resources into the problem space at various times.
Mm-hmm.
You could say, use your internet, figure out how to do this.
Yeah.
Any number of ways,
yeah.
Because the students are very resourceful at this
right.
point,
right.
and they want to get through.
Well, they are if they're motivated.
And this could motivate them.
But if you give them exactly what David said, an activity, they're unmotivated.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the examples of these conclusions where we got some really good conclusions was I picked something that motivated them extremely well, grades. So I took anonymous grade information right from the course critique here at Georgia Tech. It was for the very class I was teaching. And I gave them three or four instructors and I gave them a sample of data. Their job, figure out who was the worst instructor, best, whatever it is. And they found that, and they reverse engineered it. So the course critique doesn't give you names of students, but it does give you names of faculty. So they took the data, went to the course critique, figured out that I had the lowest average. And boy, did they make conclusions about that. Perhaps he's bitter and angry. He went bald at a young age and hasn't recovered from that. Stuff like that. But then they showed with an ANOVA analysis that they were not statistically different.
Mm.
So what you're saying is if it's problem-based learning, they will go to the literature and actually give a better introduction. These were the best introductions I ever got. They talked about grade inflation and how it happens and what the cause is and what it's like at Tech, because there were studies at Tech, how it's changed over the years. And they gave me this great graph of grade inflation over the last 50 years and showed how grade inflation went up, leveled off in the 60s, and then went up again, and pointed out these were, liberal college professors not wanting to give low grades to students with deferments from the Vietnam War.
Mm.
And I looked at the data, and immediately
they came up with that conclusion?
No, that was the conclusion. So that was their introduction. So they pointed out that grade inflation changes in its rate as a function of societal fact. And I was blown away by that. And you just don't get that in a lab. You get, we did this. We tried not to light a cigarette near the thing and blow it up because of the carrot. It's just horrible. So what you're saying is they're all a little bit integrated as well. So problem-based learning, something
problem-based learning, the reason you give them problems is the problem, if it's good enough,
mm-hmm.
drives the learning. That's why I like the term problem-driven learning.
Okay.
Because that's what happens in an authentic lab. I mean, in your lab, every day there's problems to be solved. There's
right.
a new piece of equipment. No one knows how to use it. That's a problem.
Right.
So think the learning that goes on. New piece of equipment, you put the undergrad on it.
Mm-hmm.
They're learning in trying to solve this problem of how do we get this equipment up and running.
Right. Right.
Or it could be something really complicated like how are we going to design an experiment here.
Mm-hmm.
So if we go to what I consider to be in vivo sites of learning.
Okay.
Authentic sites of learning, like a lab.
Right.
Robust learning. How do we extract design principles from those authentic in vivo sites of learning? and better replicate those in our classrooms, our synthetic environments, our in vitro environments. That's what I'm really interested in as a researcher.
And so basically what you're saying is, to some degree, we need to control for that, because some of the stuff we did with realistic things may have been written more like problem-based or problem-driven learning as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one variable. But then if you're going to do problem-driven learning, do it on a problem that they can relate to, right? And the graduate student can always relate to their problem because they're immersed in it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I like that, in vivo, in vitro.
Or they see it as authentic to the concerns of the community.
Right, right.
So, like, going back to biomedical engineering, we give them three very different problems in this semester.
Mm-hmm.
They may not like all of them. They might like one better than another.
Right.
But they get to experience a range, you know, and mm-hmm. they get to actually potentially map their understanding of themselves as potential biomedical engineers onto the problem,
and
say, I like this, I don't like this, you know, this resonates with who I want to be, what I want to become, what I want to do.
Right.
And that's really important, I think, is to have them, to have that opportunity to actually try on that identity, if you see what I'm saying.
Right.
And so often in classrooms, they're not, they don't have that opportunity. They're just running textbook problems.
Yeah, and we are not getting our chemical engineers, the way we're teaching these labs, to map themselves onto that yet. But on things that they can relate to, that mapping's happening. And then what you're saying is, try this authentic problem-driven learning to get them to map the more complicated one, the ones in their career.
Yeah.
I think once you make a conclusion once that you feel good about and you get this positive feedback, then you're willing to make conclusions about all sorts of things. Because I know this for a fact. Academics will make conclusions about everything. So we make conclusions about stuff in our domain, and then we're like, well, I'll make conclusions about that. And then your spouse tells you you're full of crap, shut up. And then you get the Nobel Prize, and then as soon as you get the Nobel Prize, you start making conclusions about societal things and all. And people are like, really? What's the... So, yeah, so they need those few honest experiences.
Well, and also, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the news, maybe every day, that it relates to chemical engineering, you know?
I think there is.
Yeah.
I try to explain it to my students.
Well, then how do you design, how do you always bring what's in the news, the Exxon Valdez, you know, oil spill, or a chemical plant that blows up that's producing pharmaceuticals, or, I mean, how do you bring those into the classroom? I think then what happens is the motivation can shoot up.
Right. And we do, but I will mention what my colleague Matthew Ralph did recently. And granted, it wasn't a recent thing, but sometimes the students are just brain dead. So we were teaching a course this summer, and he comes in and gives a lecture on design of heat exchanger networks to reclaim waste heat in a large plant. And this is not the most exciting thing on the planet. It's a lot of math.
It's also a lecture.
Well, what he does is he comes in and he throws a history lesson at him, and he shows them the price of oil over the last 60 years. And he says, there's the price of oil. There's the price of oil corrected for inflation. They're all about the same. What's this big spike in 1973? He just lets them think about it for a while. They yell things out. And then he goes back to his, look, I've told you everything in this class is motivated by two things, money or war. Which do you think it is? So somebody gets war. He goes, correct. Which one? Somebody said World War II.
73?
No, somebody said, 73. So that's what I'm saying. You know, 73, we were in Cambodia then or not or whatever. You might guess Vietnam War. We were actually out by then.
Yeah.
It was the Middle Eastern War that led to the oil embargo. And then the oil embargo made us realize that we don't have all this cheap energy anymore, so we better optimize this entire new field of reclaiming waste heat. It's a great introduction.
Yeah.
We got bupkis. We got absolutely bupkis. So we tried to turn it into a history lesson.
And they didn't buy it?
Maybe it's summer, 10 o'clock in the morning. Do we need Red Bull in the class? I don't know what it is. all right, so I'm trying to now make these our conclusions.
Are we wrapping up?
Yeah, we're wrapping up because we're over time. So in addition to those, must understand the experiment. I couldn't agree more with David. Avoid, what was it, activities and do real labs.
Right.
Try to make them the authentic experience, right? So to borrow the Latin from the bio people, the in vivo one as opposed to the in vitro, or if you chopped it out, what would that be, ex vivo, something like that? They always confuse me with that.
Ex vivo.
And then they should understand the role of both the discussion and the conclusion. And the conclusion should pay attention to how far above the data you're talking about. And if you're not far above the data, you're simply regurgitating this high school conclusion, which is a summary.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense that if we were to take something that is in their experience domain, because they don't know anything about paper mills or things like that, get them to do that. And I'm assuming when you do that, when you do Biomed 1000, you pick something that's right out in the news.
Oh, yeah. It could be New York Times, health section, turn it into a problem.
Yeah.
And they're running it 2 weeks later.
So we do that as well. So I try to take things out of the Science Times section on Tuesday of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And there's always something relevant in chemical engineering, whether it's something in your cereal or it's something with an oil spill or hydraulic fracking and things like that. But you know what I find? Our students don't read newspapers. Is there any way to get around that?
Yeah. You make it, you say, I want every week we're going to have a day where we discuss something in the news and I will randomly call on people.
Maybe assign less homework. So they can actually read the news.
Well, that's one I would agree with you on, right? If you're going to do homework.
Thank you, Austin.
the homework should be that kind of thinking about things, right? Mm-hmm. The single biggest complaint I get, and this is in GT 1000, this is in high school, is just lots of busy work.
Yeah.
Right? You just crank out 47 activities. Pressure drop calculate. Yes. No.
Can I add something to that? There is a term in education called activity mania, by the way.
Activity-mania.
Where instructors just have these activities
mindless.
That are not connected, they're not meaningful, and students experience that activity mania, and the learning outcomes show it.
That sounds like the start of a stand-up section.
I believe that's
for you.
A conclusion pivot to another show.
Another show.
So we've concluded what we think is relevant here, and hopefully we'll be able to analyze some of these things. With this NSF proposal, our next topic should be activity mania. I can't think of a better way to end the program. So let me thank you both, Wendy and David, for being on the program.
Certainly.
Let me apologize for the fact that I sent you an email early this morning when I was in another meeting and didn't even check to see if you were going to be here. But we appreciate you showing up as well. Let me congratulate Austin Redd, our engineer, for finding all the liners and the theme music and things like that. And if you have a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our theme music is performed and written by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.